And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the war in Ukraine still going on. Now Russia is talking about attacking Moldova and maybe using nuclear weapons. Today's April 28th, 118th day of the year. 247 days remain until the end of the year. If you haven't seen the news, Musk has purchased Twitter. And the liberal left is going absolutely out of its tiny little mind. He may actually allow freedom of speech. We can't have that. Well, in the year 224, the Battle of Hormazdagan is fought. And assured the first defeats and kills Artabanus V, effectively ending the Parthian Empire. 357, Emperor Constantius II enters Rome for the first time to celebrate his victory over Magnus Magnentius. 1192, assassination of Conrad of Montferrat, Conrad I, the King of Jerusalem, in Tyre, 2 days after his title to the throne is confirmed by election. Killing is carried out by the Hassanian. 1253, if I'm not mistaken, they were part of the cult of the assassins. 1253, Nichiren, a Japanese Buddhist monk, propounds Namu Myoho Renge Kyo for the very first time and declares it to be the essence of Buddhism, in effect founding Nichiren Buddhism. 1294, Timur, grandson of Kublai, is elected Khagan of the Mongols with the reigning title Ojetu. 1503, the Battle of Cerignola is fought, noted as one of the first European battles in history, won by a small arms spire using gunpowder. 1611, establishment of the Pontifical and Royal University of Santo Tomas, the Catholic University of the Philippines, the largest Catholic university in the world. 1625, a combined Spanish and Portuguese fleet of 52 ships commences the recapture of Bahia from the Dutch during the Dutch-Portuguese War. 1758, the Marathas defeat the Afghans in the Battle of Attock and capture the city. 1788, Maryland becomes the seventh state to ratify the Constitution. 1789, mutiny on the Bounty. Lieutenant William Bligh, 18 sailors are set adrift, and the rebel crew returns to Tahiti briefly and then set sail for Pitcairn Island. 1792, France invades the Austrian Netherlands, that's present-day Belgium and Luxembourg, beginning the French Revolutionary Wars. 1794, Sardinians, beheaded by Giovanni Maria and start a revolution against the Savoy domination, expelling Viceroy Balbiano and his officials from Cagliari, the capital and the largest city on the island. 1796, the Armistice of Cherasco was signed by Napoleon and Vittorio Amedeo III, King of Sardinia, expanding French territory along the Mediterranean coast. 1869, Chinese and Irish laborers for the Central Pacific Railroad, working on the first transcontinental railroad, laid 10 miles of track in one day, a feat that has never been matched. 1881, Billy the Kid escapes from the Lincoln County Jail in Mesilla, New Mexico. 1887, a week after being arrested by the Prussian secret police, French police inspector Guillaume Sabinabelli is released on order of William I, the German Emperor, which defused a possible war. Frenchman Louis Pohan wins the 1910 London to Manchester air race, the first long-distance aeroplane race in the United Kingdom. 1920, the Azerbaijan Soviet Socialist Republic is founded. 1923, Wembley Stadium is open, named initially as the Empire Stadium. 1930, Independence Producers hosted the first night game in the history of organized baseball in Independence, Kansas. 1941, the Ustasi Massacre took place. Nearly 200 Serbs in the village of Gudovac, the first massacre of their genocidal campaign against Serbs of the independent state of Croatia. 1944, World War II. 9 German E-boats attack U.S. and U.K. units during Exercise Tiger, the rehearsal for the Normandy landings. They killed 946. 1945, Benito Mussolini and his mistress, Clara Petacci, are shot dead by Walter Odusio, a member of the Italian resistance movement. Clara Petacci, I guess is her name, was the mistress of the Italian dictator killed during Mussolini's execution. Threw herself on him in a vain attempt to protect him from the bullets is what's supposed to have happened. She was 33 years of age. And from all accounts, very attractive young lady. 1945, the Holocaust. Nazi Germany carries out its final use of gas chambers to execute 33 Upper Austrian socialists and communist leaders in the Mauthausen concentration camp. 1947, Thor Heyerdahl and 5 crewmates set out from Peru on the Kon-Tiki to demonstrate that Peruvian natives could have settled Polynesia. 1948, Igor Stravinsky conducted the premiere of the American ballet, Orpheus, in the New York City Center. 1949, Bahuk Balahap are accused of assassinating former First Lady of the Philippines, Oro Quezon, while she is en route to dedicate a hospital in memory of her late husband. Her daughter and 10 others are also killed. Bahuk Balahap, also known as the People's Army Against the Japanese, better known as the Hucks, was a communist guerrilla movement formed by the farmers of central Luzon. Originally formed to fight the Japanese, but continued their fight into a rebellion against the Philippine government. Put down through a series of reforms and military victories by Defense Secretary and later President Ramon Magsaysay. The unfortunate fact is, they get to a point where they kill indiscriminately. She was Aurora Antonia Quezon, also known as Aragon y Molina. As I say, wife of the Philippine President Manuel Luis Quezon and the First Lady of the Philippines until 1944. Although she's recognized as the second First Lady of the Philippines, she was actually the first spouse of a Philippine president to be addressed as such. The honorific being unknown in the Philippines prior to Manuel Quezon becoming president. She was heavily involved in humanitarian activities, and she was the first chairperson of the Philippines National Red Cross. The province of Aurora in the Philippines is named in her memory. And I'm sure it made them feel good, the Hucks, to shoot a defenseless woman. 1952, Dwight Eisenhower resigns as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in order to campaign for the 1952 U.S. presidential election. Also in 52, the Treaty of San Francisco comes into effect, restoring Japanese sovereignty and ending its state of war with most of the allies of World War II. 1952 as well, the Sino-Japanese Peace Treaty, known as the Treaty of Taipei, is signed in Taipei, Taiwan, between Japan and Republic of China to officially end the Second Sino-Japanese War. 1965, the U.S. occupation of the Dominican Republic took place during this period. American troops land in the Dominican Republic to forestall the establishment of a communist dictatorship and evacuate U.S. Army troops who were already there. 1967, Vietnam War. Boxer Muhammad Ali refuses his induction into the U.S. Army and subsequently stripped of his championship and license to fight. They said, if you don't want to fight, you're not going to fight. 1973, The Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd, recorded in Abbey Road Studios, goes to number one on the U.S. Billboard chart, beginning a record-breaking 741-week chart run. 1975, General Cao Van Vien, chief of the South Vietnamese military, departs for the U.S. as the North Vietnamese Army closes in on victory. You know, once we pulled out, it was a domino effect. We did the same thing in Afghanistan, but this time we ran. '77, Red Army faction trial ends with Andreas Bader, Gudrun Insulin, and Jan Carl Raspe found guilty of 4 counts of murder and more than 30 counts of attempted murder. 1978, the president of Afghanistan, Mohammad Daoud Khan, is overthrown and assassinated in a coup led by pro-communist rebels. 1986, high levels of radiation resulting from the Chernobyl disaster detected at a nuclear power plant in Sweden, leading Soviet officials to publicly announce the accident. 1988, near Maui, Hawaii, flight attendant Claribel C.B. Lansing is blown out of an Aloha Airlines Flight 243, that was a Boeing 737, don't you know, and falls to her death when part of the plane's fuselage rips open in mid-flight. 1994, former CIA counterintelligence officer and analyst Aldrich Ames pleads guilty to giving U.S. secrets to the Soviet Union and later to Russia. 1996, Whitewater controversy. President Bill Clinton gives a 4.5-hour videotaped testimony for the defense. 1996, Port Arthur massacre in Tasmania. A gunman, Martin Bryant, opens fire at the Broad Arrow Cafe in Port Arthur, Tasmania, kills 35 and wounds 23 others. 2004, CBS News released evidence of the Abu Ghraib torture and prisoner abuse. These photographs show rape and abuse from the American troops over Iraqi detainees. And I'm sure CBS thought that they did a great service in getting that scoop. Alrighty, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Aphrodisias and Companions, Gianna Beretta Mola, Kirill of Tarov in the Orthodox, added to the Roman Martyrology in 1969, Louis de Montfort, Pamphilius of Somona, Peter Chanel, Vitalis and Valeria of Milan, Mujahideen Victory Day in Afghanistan. National, I think that's directed toward their chasing the Soviets out. We have Joe Biden to thank for telling her husband to get the troops out of there. National Heroes Day in Barbados, Restoration of Sovereignty Day in Japan, Sardinia Day in Sardinia, and Workers' Memorial Day and World Day for Safety and Health at Work internationally, and National Day of Mourning in Canada. Let's see what else we have. In 1180, Philip II of France, who was 14 years old, marries his first wife, Isabella of Hainault. She was 10 at Epome. In 1202, King Philip II expels King John of England That was John Lackland, the brother of Richard the Lionhearted, from France. 1253, Utrecht is destroyed by fire. 1376, the English Parliament demanded they have the right to supervise royal spending. 1503, Battle of Cerignano. Spanish army under Gonzalo Fernandez de Cordoba defeats a French force led by Louis de Armagnac, Duke of Nemours. 1521, the Treaty of Worms. Emperor Charles names his brother Ferdinand Archduke of the Netherlands and Austria. 1550, the power of the Dutch Inquisition is extended. 1635, Virginia Governor John Harvey accused of treason and removed from office. 1655, English General at Sea Robert Blake beats the North African pirate fleet. Though he was acting as an admiral, he never got the title admiral. 1789, I mentioned this earlier, Fletcher Christian leads a mutiny on the HMS Bounty against its captain, William Bligh. Took place in the South Pacific. Bligh was the commander of a British naval expedition to procure a source of food to feed slaves in the Caribbean plantations. They were bringing back breadfruit from Tahiti in the South Pacific. 1790, Bligh's men were so enraged by their commander's antagonistic attitude, and he, in turn, believed that they were incompetent. So a mutiny, led by Fletcher Christian, occurred 3 weeks into the voyage. Bligh and 18 men were put into a 6-meter-long launch. And they made the remarkable 1,500-kilometer voyage to Timor. Bligh went on to have several further commands. He was a disastrous governor of New South Wales, and his abusive attitude helped spark the Rum Rebellion, and finally he got removed from his post. He died in 1817 at the age of 63. 1800, gained a reputation as one of the most sadistic naval commanders afloat. 1796, the ceasefire of Cerasco between Sardinia and Napoleon Bonaparte. 1804, 31 British ships sail up the Suriname River demanding transition colony from the Dutch. 1818, President James Monroe proclaims naval disarmament on the Great Lakes and Lake Champlain. 1829, the Dutch Parliament accepts new press laws. 1847, George Vachon becomes the first African-American to enter the New York State Bar. 1848, slavery abolished in the French colonies. 1855, the first veterinary college in the U.S. is incorporated in Boston. 1902, using the ISO 8601 standard year zero definition for the Gregorian calendar, preceded by the Julian calendar, the 1 billionth minute since the start of January 1st, year zero, occurred at 10:40 a.m. on April 28th, 1902. 1910, first night air flight by Claude Graham White took place in England. 1914, 181 die in a coal mine collapse in Eccles, West Virginia. 1919, saw the first jump with the U.S. Army Air Corps ripcord-type parachute. It was done by Les Irvin. 1922, WOI out of Ames, Iowa, is the country's first licensed educational radio station. 1925, the Kurdish rebels surrendered to the Turkish army. 1934, President FDR signs the Homeowners Loan Act. 1939, Adolf Hitler claims the German-Polish non-attack treaty is still in effect. 1940, SS Obersturmbannführer, Lieutenant Colonel Rudolf Höss, not Hess, he's a different Nazi, becomes commandant of the concentration camp Auschwitz. 1941, saw the last British troops in Greece surrender. 1942, the German Luftwaffe estimated to have flown over 11,000 sorties against Malta since the 20th of March of 42. 1942, a Gallup poll determined that the name for the Second World War should be World War II. 1942, saw a nightly dim out begin along the East Coast. 1943, there was German-Italian counteroffensive in North Africa. 1943, U.S. 34th Division occupies Jebel El Hara in North Tunisia. 1945, British commandos attack Elba and occupy Lorenburg. 1945, the U.S. 5th Army reaches the Swiss border. 1952, World War II Pacific Peace Treaty takes effect. 1956, on this date, the last French troops leave Vietnam. 1958, Vice President Richard M. Nixon begins a goodwill tour of Latin America. All right, we have ended our little history segment. We're going to talk about some more strange and unusual things about this country. We've been talking about the Lewis and Clark expedition and some of the unique occurrences that took place. You know, they were actually the first official expedition to go west. And nobody really knew what they were going to find. There were many, many stories about, shall we say, lost colonies on the continent. For example, there was supposed to be a Roman colony outside of Tucson that dated from about the year 1000. And ruins had been found. Supposedly, they tried to instill the same procedures in the New World that they had in the Old World, and the local natives weren't in favor of that and stomped the crap out of them. Well, on November 7th, 1805, Clark wrote in his journal, "The ocean's in view." He thought it was just a short distance from the Great Pacific. And then on the morning of November 8th, 1805, he wrote that the entire party changed clothes. Custom at that time was for travelers to stop at the end of a long journey and get ready by putting on their best clothes for arrival. So this shows that Lewis and Clark expected November 8th to be the day they'd stand on the shores of the Pacific Ocean. However, when they were 20 miles from the coast, weather changed and they were forced to go to ground. They were hit by rolling breakers so big they had to turn around. They pushed ahead against all odds, now facing a river entrance that in later years would be known as the Graveyard of Ships. After two other attempts that day to get to the coast, they were forced to camp on a little beach, where they experienced that night thunderstorms and wind and hail and rocks falling from the cliffs above them and logs tossed to the shore by the surf. They were forced to abandon most of their supplies. They buried their canoes and found shelter in a wooded area around the point. Days later, the weather changed and they were able to leave their refuge. Historian Rex Ziach's book, In Full View, written in 2001, is a beautifully designed book that chronicles each step of the expedition carefully and accurately thanks to a mislabeled map drawn by Clark. Ziach explains it was a virtual treasure map with coordinates pointing to a spot called Station Camp. It was on that spot, November 15th, 1805, when the Corps of Discovery is finally able to establish a stable camp and where Clark will write words of great significance. Sergeant Patrick Cross, Gass, G-A-S-S, further substantiated the location when he wrote in his diary on November 16th, 1805, "We're now at the end of our voyage, which has been completely accomplished." According to Ziach, this entry means Station Camp was where Lewis and Clark's voyage of discovery was completed. Station Camp in Washington, not Fort Catsop in Oregon. Now, on the evening of the 24th of November, 1805, Lewis and Clark polled the entire party about whether to spend the winter near the ocean on the south side of the Columbia or somewhat further upriver. This famous vote's the first in American history to include a black voter. It was a black slave named York who was Clark's servant, and an Indian woman, Sacagawea, got the vote. And while the vote was being discussed, Clark would carve on a tree William Clark by land from the U states in 1804 and 5. It was in this peninsula on the southwest tip of Washington where Mary the Lewis and William Clark ended their trip west. So now they had to wait out 3.5 harsh months at Fort Catsop in present-day Oregon before beginning the journey back home. Now, during the long winter, it became apparent that the worlds of Lewis and Clark and that of the natives were as different as night and day. Lewis and Clark finally reached the Pacific Ocean. They literally became beachcombers, traveling as far south as an area now known as Ecola Beach State Park and as far north as Astoria, Oregon. During an exploration of the area, Clark would give Tillamook Head, located between Seaside and Cannon Beach, the title of the steepest, worst, and highest mountain I ever ascended. December 25th, 1806, Clark and 12 other expedition members, including Sacagawea, she was about 15 at the time and had a child, climbed over rocky hills, fighting their way through thick brush and trees. And from this vantage point, they saw the skeleton of a beached whale south of what's now Ecola State Park. If they'd done a little more exploring in that area, they would have unearthed ancient Chinese coins. An article written in 2006, journalist Richard Blake made mention of ancient Chinese coins from the Song Dynasty that had been found at the mouth of the Yucala River. These coins are kept at the Cannon Beach Historical Society Museum in Cannon Beach. In addition, records kept by the Song Dynasty claim that Chinese explorers reached the West Coast about 70 years before Columbus reached the East Coast. Now, the amount of anthropological and archaeological oddities that connect the Washington and Oregon coast with Asia, and specifically China, are somewhat scarce, but they do exist. Problem remains that most of the evidence has gone into private collections. Little that remains at universities is ignored and tucked away in dusty archives, as is the case in most museums as well. Some examples of anomalies that have come to light are the documenting of various native groups on Vancouver Island who look distinctly Chinese compared to their neighboring tribes. In addition, cave burials along the west coast of Vancouver Island turned up distinctly Chinese relics, including skeletons. And these skeletons are different in size and stature from those of native peoples along the coast. Excavations in Tillamook County by the University of Oregon in the early 70s unearthed ancient Chinese vases and pottery. In the early to mid-70s, Washington State University archaeologists examined a piece of bronze work that was hauled up by a fishing boat near the mouth of the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Archaeologists led by Dr. Richard Daughtry of Washington State University thought the piece to be of Chinese origin and possibly a ship's decoration of some kind. Daughtry had hoped the university had acquired the relic, but it was sold to a private party and vanished. Now, the most alluring of all the Asian Pacific Northwest connections is the enigmatic and controversial Kennewick Man. That's the name given to the remains of a prehistoric man found on the bank of the Columbia River near Kennewick, Washington. It's found July 28, 1996. While swimming in the river during the annual hydroplane races, two college students accidentally made the discovery of a man's skull. Turned out to belong to the most complete ancient skeleton ever found. The bones were dubbed the Kennewick Man. Immediately, the remains became embroiled in debates about relationships between Native American religious rites and archaeology that launched a 9-year legal battle between scientists, the federal government, and Native American tribes. Tribes, of course, claimed the Kennewick Man as their ancestor. And the long dispute made the remains an international celebrity, subject of documentaries, websites, books, and even the cover of Time magazine. Controversy came so convoluted that the long litigation process has relegated this amazing cultural discovery to a university basement. Today, secrets held by the Kennewick Man continue to be, at least for the public, deep, dark secrets. Then Benton County Coroner Floyd Johnson reached out to a forensic anthropologist in Richland by the name of Jim Chatters, who studied the bones before a detailed analysis could be made. About a month later, Chatters and Johnson announced the skeleton was about 9,200 years old and speculated the man appeared to be in his 40s or 50s when he died, making him very old for that period. They also noted the skeleton showed a heel broken arm and a heel broken rib, and they found a roughly 1-inch basalt spear point embedded in his pelvic bone. Now, that wasn't the cause of his death. Before a detailed scientific analysis was completed, a digital reconstruction of the skull revealed the features were Caucasoid. When the media broke the story, a great deal of coverage emphasized the similarity in appearance between the Kennewick Man and the Star Trek actor Patrick Stewart. This flurry of coverage served the purpose of telling the truth about the discovery of Kennewick Man, but it frankly depicted discovery as a joke. But there's far more to this story than what's been broadcast thus far. History of the colonization of North America by humans has been represented as a trickle of migration across the Bering Strait land bridge during the last ice age. But more recent archaeological research has begun to uncover an enormous amount of evidence that actually speaks to the contrary. Evidence suggests there was a much more complex and sizable migration in North America than we've been told thus far. Archaeologists such as Thor Heyerdahl, for example, are convinced the colonization of North America by humans came in multiple waves through different means and from different regions. Kennewick Man is further evidence of such a colonization wave. Now, the Army Corps of Engineers owns the Columbia River shoreline through the Tri-Cities, so it actually claimed ownership of the skeleton. However, according to the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, signed into law by President Bush, H.W. Bush, Mr. I don't know nothing about the CIA, who used to run it, he signed it in 1990. If human remains are found on federal lands and a cultural affiliation can be established, the bones must be returned to the affiliated tribe. Based on this act, five Native American natives, the Nez Perce, the Umatilla, the Yakama, the Wanapum, and the Colville, claimed the remains as theirs. In April 1998, to protect any other skeletons, artifacts from the curious hands of archaeologists, the Army Corps of Engineers covered the Kennewick site with 500 tons of rock fill. Curiously, we find the Smithsonian Institution embroiled in the act as well, with Douglas Owsley, a Smithsonian anthropologist, taking over the disputed remains, refusing to turn them over to any of the Native nations. He contends the remains' potential contribution to science is too great, and that Kennewick Man couldn't be linked to any one tribe. Owsley, along with eight other anthropologists, filed a lawsuit on the matter in 1996 in U.S. District Court in Portland, Oregon. The five Native nations fought the anthropologists in court, claiming the repatriation law covered the Kennewick Man. At scientific examinations, disrespected Native American beliefs about the sanctity of their dead. However, in 2002, Judge John Jeldertz ruled in the anthropologist's favor. Ruling didn't set a timetable for the studies to be completed or even for publication. Army Corps of Engineers, which remains the legal guardian of Kennewick Man, put him in the Burke Museum, a neutral site agreeable to both the tribes and the scientists. Now, due to the costly litigation process for the five Native American nations, all but the Umatillas dropped their claims. Umatilla, the tribe of Native Americans, requested custody of the remains, wanting to bury them according to tribal tradition. However, researchers, hoping to study the remains, contested the claim. The Umatilla tradition holds that their people have been present on the land since the dawn of time. And the government assertion that Kennewick Man is not Native American is tantamount to the government's rejecting their beliefs, is what they say. Interestingly enough, the government's assertion lends credence to the argument Kennewick Man descends from a race other than the indigenous Northwest Native people. February 4, 2004, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled that the cultural link between the tribes and the skeleton was not met. The tribe dropped their custody lawsuit at that point, and the ruling supposedly opened the door for more scientific study. Well, in April 2005, U.S. Senator John Wonderful McCain introduced and later pushed through an amendment to the NAGPRA, which in Section 108 would change the definition of Native American from being that which is indigenous to the U.S. or is or was indigenous to the U.S. By that definition, Kennewick Man would be Native American, whether or not any link to a contemporary tribe could be found. Proponents of this interpretation argue that this remains in accord with current scientific understanding. It's not in all cases possible for prehistoric remains to be traced to current tribal bloodlines. And of course, there's been a lot of argument about just what is a Native American. The difficulty is attributed to a long history of social upheaval, forced resettlement, and extinction of entire ethnicities caused by disease and warfare in the wake of European colonization. But McCain's redefinition did not remove the controversy surrounding Kennewick Man. July 2005, some of the nation's leading scientists convened in Seattle for 10 days to study the remains. After making many detailed measurements and tests and analysis, they released some of their findings. But as far as the general public goes, the secrets of the Kennewick Man are still secret. C. Loring Brace is a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan, and he was one of the scientists who had to wait 9 years to study this famous skeleton. He said, "One look at that thing, and I knew it was going to relate to the Ainu of Japan. They were the original and first people of Japan before being hunted into extinction in their own homeland. And the idea of this tribe roaming the Northwest represented a radical shift in traditional thinking. When Kennewick Man was first discovered, he was initially thought to be European. But as Brace explains, the Ainu don't look like any other Japanese. They've got light skin, wavy hair, body hair. They don't look, eyes don't look Asian at all." John Stang of Seattle Post Intelligence, or correspondent who authored a detailed account of Kennewick Man's Odyssey, interviewed Brian Early, a spokesman for the Smithsonian Institute, about what the public may expect to read, when the public may expect to read the conclusion drawn from the examination at the University of Washington's Burke Museum. In a typical Smithsonian answer, he said the scientists are unsure how long it would take until their findings are published. Stephanie Joyvet, the museum's public outreach coordinator, was quoted in the article as saying, "It's odd to me there hadn't been any preliminary results released as of yet." When the 2006 examination was finished, the only statements offered indicate Kennewick Man was likely in his 30s when he died and the spear wound didn't kill him. And the estimated age of the skeleton was between 8,200 and 9,500 years. They did little more than confirm the original study completed by Chatters and Johnson in 1996. Since 2006, nothing's been publicly disclosed about the studies conducted on the remains. Kennewick Man today is stored in boxes in the Burke Museum's basement at a premium of $30,000 a year for insurance. And the museum doesn't reveal the remains' exact location for security reasons, but it is interesting to note that neither the Corps of Engineers nor the Umatilla Nation, which had the highest profile during the litigation, have any idea of the progress made by scientists. No one has either reported seeing the remains of the Kennewick Man since 2006. Other researchers have requested access to the skeleton for their own measurements and DNA studies, but so far the Corps has denied every request. Rather than clearing the area for more revealing investigations, the Army Corps of Engineers elected to dump another 500 tons of concrete and rock on the discovery site. So rather than make Kennewick Man's remains available to anthropologists or researchers, access is routinely denied. Rather than turning the bones over to the tribe that claims the remains as their ancestor based on legal rights given them by the government, the bones are kept locked up in the basement. There are many who believe the answer could be that Kennewick Man is associated with an ancient and advanced civilization, and an explanation as to why his remains have turned up is dreaded by a number of various authorities. And that would explain why the extreme steps have been taken to patently remove the discovery from public awareness. Now, the Kennewick Man can be compared with the discovery of a 10,300-year-old skeleton discovered in On Your Knees Cave in southeast Alaska's Prince of Wales Island. The remains were named Sukukai, which means man ahead of us. Sukukai is estimated to be roughly 20 years old at the time he died. Anthropologists involved in this discovery quickly turned the incomplete remains over to the native tribe of the area for burial. Some speculate that a legal battle over incomplete remains wouldn't likely contribute to current knowledge and it'd be a waste. According to Michael Cremo's book, Forbidden Archaeology, there's a great deal of additional documentation that suggests modern humankind's antiquity far exceeds accepted chronologies. For example, Cremo offers a report from the June 11, 1891 edition of the Morrisville Times. According to this story, a curious find was brought to light by Ms. S.W. Gulp last Tuesday morning. As she was breaking a lump of coal preparatory to putting it in the scuttle, she discovered, as the lump fell apart, embedded in a circular shape, a small gold chain about 10 inches in length of antique and quaint workmanship. At first, she thought the chain had been dropped accidentally in the coal, but as she undertook to lift the chain up, the idea of it having been recently dropped was at once made fallacious. For as the lump of coal broke, it separated almost in the middle. In the circular position of the chain, placed the two ends near to each other. And as the lump separated, the middle of the chain became loosened while each end remained fastened to the coal. The chain was an 8-carat gold and weighed 8 penny ounces. He notes the Illinois State Geological Survey contend the coal encasing the gold chain was between 260 and 320 million years old. There was another instance involving a report issued in 1871 by William Dubois of the Smithsonian Institution. He reported several man-made objects were found at unusual depths during drilling in Illinois. First object was what appeared to be a copper coin. In a letter to the Smithsonian, the driller said he discovered the coin stuck to a common ground auger after drilling 125 feet. Later reports suggest the object had been discovered at a depth of 114 feet rather than 125. Illinois State Geological Survey offered an estimate for the age of deposits found at the 114-foot levels as being sometime between 200,000 and 400,000 years ago. Dubois said the coin contained crude inscriptions in a language he didn't recognize, and the coin's overall appearance differed from any known coin. And he seemed certain the object was made in a machine shop. He said the uniform thickness of the coin indicated it had been passed through a rolling mill, and if ancient Indians had such a contrivance, it must have been prehistoric. The object, according to experts noted by Cremo, suggests the existence of a civilization at least 200,000 years ago in North America. And this directly contradicts the widely held assumption that the earliest humans intelligent enough to make and use coins lived only 100,000 years ago. Well, in Whiteside County, Illinois, at a depth of 120 feet, workers discovered a small trove of objects, including a large copper ring or ferrule, similar to those used on ship spars at the present time. They also found something fashioned like a boat hook. One observer noted there are numerous instances of relics found at lesser depths. A spear-shaped hatchet made of iron was found embedded in clay at 40 feet, and stone pipes and pottery have been unearthed at depths varying from 10 to 50 feet in many localities. September of 1984, the Illinois State Geological Survey wrote to Cremo and his associates that the age of deposits at 120 feet in Whiteside County varied greatly. In some places, you'd find at 120 feet deposits only 50,000 years old. Other places, one would find Silurian bedrock 410 million years old. Seeing the sort of territorial rage evoked by these sorts of claims emerged in 1996 when NBC broadcast a primetime special called The Mysterious Origins of Man. The special featured material from Cremo's book, and it sent America's academic and scientific communities into a fit. The reaction from the scientific community was especially fiery, as NBC was inundated with letters from irate scientists. Amid cries of hoax, the scientists tried to force NBC to agree never to re-air the broadcast. When that didn't work, opponent scientists took their case to the FCC. In a letter to the FCC, Dr. Allison Palmer, president of the Institute for Cambrian Studies, said at the very least NBC should be required to make substantial primetime apologies to their viewing audiences for a specific period of time so the audience clearly gets the message they were duped. Well, it's typical to the attitude of the left. No one can be right but them. But if the scientists were apoplectic about the special, wait till they hear about the proof of giants in North America. That'll really send them off the rail. Well, there are those that refer to Meriwether Lewis as a giant of American history. But they don't realize when they use that phrase is he may have been preceded by an entire race of real historical giants. Despite being a prominent theme in all the world's mythologies, the lore about giants generally remains in the realm of children's tales. It seems odd, then, that the ancient peoples from far different parts of the globe would all write and speak of the age of giants. Even the Bible talks about them, the Nephilim. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4 says there were giants in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. In another famous biblical account, we learned about the battle between David and Goliath. While digging at Tel Asafari in 2005, archaeologists from Berlin University in Israel discovered pottery shards mentioning the name of Goliath. Writing on the shards represents the oldest Philistine inscriptions ever found. The area of Tel Safai is known in ancient times as the land of Gath. Encompasses an area surrounding two large mounds located on the border between the Judean foothills and the coastal plain. Covering more than 100 acres, it's one of the most important archaeological sites in Israel. Professor Ayn Marier, a director of the Tel Safai Gath Archaeological Project, suggests the discoveries being made point to all the legends being real. He said in the press release issued by Berlin University, this inscription appears to provide evidence that the biblical story of Goliath is in fact based on more or less the time which is depicted in the biblical text. And recent attempts to claim that Goliath can only be understood in the context of later phases of the Iron Age are unwarranted. What's more surprising are the additional biblical accounts that talk about giants living in the West. Some of the American giants' last days have been preserved in what remains of the writings of the conquistadors. Valuable information contained in the various writings from the Spanish invasion of the New World is so fantastic it's hard to believe what they say. And thanks to the tremendous amount of research done by Stephen Quayle, who brought to light the verified written accounts of giants from the early 16th century, there now appears to be bona fide written evidence that as little as 500 years ago, giants were living in the Americas. 1519, Alonso Alvarez de Pineda mapped the islands along the Gulf Coast, strategically marking the various rivers and bays, notable landmarks and porting areas, all of which, according to the Pope, belonged to the King of Spain. After covering the coastlines from Florida to as far as Tampico, Mexico, Pineda sailed back to the mouth of the Mississippi River. He was the first Spanish explorer to venture up the Mississippi, and he reported finding a large settlement of native villages inhabited by giants. After the giants proved to be friendly, Pineda and the crew settled among them the rest to make repairs. He also detailed the abundance of gold found in the river and how the natives wore plenty of gold engraved ornaments. It's amazing how Pineda was more interested in the lands, good food, and the shock of discovering giants than he was in the gold. I mean, that was totally not in keeping with the philosophy of the conquistadors. As he sailed back to his home base in Jamaica, made note of more giants encountered on the various islands of the Texas coast. When he returned, he presented Francisco de Garay, the Spanish governor of Jamaica, with the maps and sketches of the entire Gulf Coast. The first known map of the Gulf also included Pineda's writings about this fantastic race of giants that lived there. These sketches and writings are known as Garay's Cadula and were archived by the famous Spanish compiler, Martin Fernandez de Navarrete. They can be found today by visiting the Archivo General de Indias in Seville, Spain. 20 years after Pineda mapped the Gulf, Francisco Coronado marched with a huge expedition across the American Southwest searching for the legendary seven cities of Cibola, or what we refer to today as El Dorado. While on their quest, Coronado's expedition crossed paths with several tribes of Indian giants. And we have this information thanks to the writings of Pedro de Castaneda, who went with Coronado and wrote a complete and amazing history of the expedition. Fascinating tale concerning giants found in Castaneda's book details the journey made by Hernando de Alarcón. Low on provisions, a frantic Coronado sent Alarcón to find a river that could bring supplies more easily to the Spanish outpost along the California-Mexican coast. After nearly destroying his ships and missing the waiting party at the rendezvous point, he haphazardly floated up the mouth of the Colorado River. Alarcón and his men became the first Europeans to fight the rapids as he brought his fleet into the heart of the Colorado River, reaching as far as the lower reaches of the Grand Canyon. While coasting up the river, Alarcón and his men came upon the settlement of an estimated 200 giant warriors. And these giants, amazed by foreign intruders on the riverbank, were ready to attack. But Alarcón defused the situation by making peace and offering gifts, which eventually won the giants over. These giants later categorized with the prevailing tribes of the area as being the Cocopa Indians. 1,000 more members of this giant tribe were discovered and reported further upstream. And discoveries of giants have also been reported in Mexico. The Dominican friar Diego Duran is responsible for writing some of the earliest Western books on the history and culture of the Aztecs. His family moved from Spain to Mexico City when he was very young, and it allowed him to grow up around the remaining natives of Mexico. While attending school, he was frequently exposed to Aztec culture, then under the colonial rule of Spain, and he continued to study and travel within the remaining city-states of the Aztec Empire. In Texcoco, he learned to speak and read the native Natal Aztec language, and by winning the Aztecs' trust, he was able to gain access to a vast amount of knowledge concerning the history of pre-Columbian Mexico. Well, his writings are some of the oldest known surviving texts that give us actual first-hand narratives about the ancient Aztecs. Because he spent 32 years among the Aztecs gathering information, learning how to read ancient native hieroglyphs, and interviewing old shamans, scholars regard his work as extremely important. In the History of the Indies of New Spain, he exhaustively describes the history of Mexico from its mysterious ancient origins up to conquest and occupation by the Spaniards. And in these writings, the Aztecs weren't shy when it came to talking about the giants. But Duran didn't need to hear or read about them. He could actually see them. Living in Mexico, he came in contact with giant Indians on several occasions. Well, at this point, we've run out of time for today's show. We'll be back tomorrow when we'll talk more about the giants that lived in North America. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.